This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
You can detect both people that are at high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease 10 years before they develop dementia.
New research out of Sweden suggests that this risk determination can happen far earlier than ever before. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. So, you've heard of Berlin and London as being hubs for startup companies, but what about Riga, Latvia?
What we're hoping is that this is the home of the new Skype that will come out of Latvia, that this is it's a great place for technology startups.
And new research from Austria suggests that antibiotic resistance may become a thing of the past. But first, a new Berlin company wants to change the way you buy clothes online forever. All that and more this week on Spectrum. Shopping online has opened up a whole realm of bargains, from electronics to books and DVDs. But while 50% of all computer sales are online, buying clothes is a whole different kettle of fish, dropping down to just 7% of sales. The main problem with buying clothes online is finding the right fit, and people are generally more hesitant to buy clothes without trying them on first. If people do jump in and take the online retail challenge, there's a high chance they'll be sending those clothes back to the retailer. According to a research institute attached to the University of Regensburg in southeastern Germany, 40% of all clothes bought online are returned. But a new Berlin-based startup called UpClothe has come up with a solution using a webcam and a CD. Cinema Nippard has more from Berlin.
Okay, nimm deine CD, checke, dass dein Nacken noch immer frei ist und klick auf den Startbutton.
So first you have to ensure that both your head and feet are inside the frame, and then you can press start and the process begins.
That's Sebastian Schulz, 24-year-old co-founder of UpClothe. He and Asaf Moses partnered with Imagoo, an Israeli company specialized in object segmentation to realize the UpClothe webcam measuring system. To be measured accurately, you need to wear tight-fitting dark clothes and have a CD and webcam handy. Sebastian starts the program and I stand back a couple of meters and line myself up with the model on the laptop screen.
Dein Kopf sollte im Kreis sein und das Dreieck befindet sich jetzt zwischen deinen Beinen.
I hold the CD in front of my waist and follow the UpClothe model's instructions as she talks me through each step of the process and shows me what to do.
Bitte bleib jetzt stillstehen. Das Scanning beginnt.
First you face the front, line up your head with the circles on the screen and stretch out your arms. Then you have to turn to the side and then again with your back to the camera. The process is pretty straightforward and only takes a few minutes. But Sebastian Schultz says that developing the software wasn't easy. There were three main challenges. First, they had to get the software to recognize what is and isn't a person. And secondly, the software has to create a silhouette of the person.
The third step is that you localize the measurement points. For example, where is the shoulder, where is the wrist, where is the chest? And at the end, you have to measure accurately and calibrate the measurements, and therefore we use CD.
Sebastian and Asaf had to come up with a standard object that most people would have in their households and found that a CD is a reliable calibration tool. After UpClothe gives me my measurements, I ask Sebastian to double-check it with a tape measure.
I measured by tape 31 centimeters, and also the software tells us 31, so you see it's in the neck, it's quite accurate.
While there was 1 centimeter deviation in arm length, Sebastian says that the most important measurement to get right is the neck, and the other measurements can be calibrated to that. Turns out, UpClothe is as accurate as a professional tailor. But Sucharita Molparu, analyst at Forrester Research in the United States, says that UpClothe isn't the only startup on the block trying to solve this problem.
There are different approaches. I mean, there are companies like IntelliFit that have done, kind of body scanning of people, in the past. There are machines that you stand in and you get measured. There are companies that essentially use seemingly a form of augmented reality where, you're using a webcam and, kind of putting clothes on top of you.
Here in Europe, Estonian startup FitsMe and Dutch startup MimicMe fall into the virtual fitting room categories. But to use them, you need to have your personal measurements, which is where UpClode comes in. And they're looking to partner with a company offering such a service. But Mulperu says that there are other variables to consider when shopping online for clothes.
The challenge is that, you know, kind of dimensions are only one portion of fit. And, you know, I can throw out a bunch of dimensions. You know, whether or not a particular product is going to look good on that person, whether or not a person is going to feel comfortable wearing that product, or they're completely different questions.
And that's the problem with buying clothes online. They're intensely personal, especially for women who tend to spend a lot more time and money buying clothes than men. While I buy lots of music, some books and electronics online, I rarely buy clothes online. And when I do, oftentimes I have to return them. But Sebastian Schultz hopes that UpClode can reduce the number of returns.
The biggest pain in apparel e-commerce are the returns. One return costs about €21, and you have an average return rate of 50% in Germany. That means every second clothing item is returned back to the retailer. And the costs of returns are accumulated to more than €600 million only in Germany.
Schultz and Moses hope that UpClode will benefit both consumers and clothing manufacturers. Christoph Rettke is a well-known Berlin startup guru, and he's impressed by this locally grown company.
I think they fit in the place that matters most, which is technology that actually has an impact on people's everyday life.
UpClode was recently voted Startup of the Year by Deutsche Startups, winning €100,000 in prize money and €100,000 in government grants. Currently in beta testing phase, UpClode will launch in the first quarter of 2012. Cinema Nippard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Cyrus Farivar. Now, if you're like me and you're never near the actual radio, feel free to download Spectrum as a podcast. Take us with you on your commute or listen at your computer, whenever you like. Every day when I bike to work, I always have my favorite podcast in my earbuds. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's going on. Beyond that, come and interact with us. See what I'm reading and get a taste of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. Send me a message and I will write you back. Promise. And now it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
In East London, there's a small area known as the Silicon Roundabout. We've covered it here on Spectrum before. One of its anchors is Tech Hub, a co-working space that was co-founded by one of the editors at TechCrunch Europe. That's one of the most well-known tech blogs on the continent. Next month, Tech Hub is expanding for the first time to the mainland. Over in Latvia, Tech Hub Riga will offer a co-working space for new IT startups and will hold various local and international events on a regular basis. From Riga, Gerhard Gelsis reports.
The final repairs are being carried out on the fifth floor at a historical building on Citadel Street, just a 10-minute walk from the Riga Old Town. Though the doors are still closed for visitors, the spacious area of 400 square meters will soon turn into a focal point for many new Latvian IT entrepreneurs here. The 40-year-old Anders Bērziņš is one of the founders behind TechUp Riga. He says that everything grew out of four Latvian startups who wanted a co-working space here in Riga, and they decided to approach the TechUp in London.
TechUp saw in us a team that was ready to roll, that was very active. They came and visited us here. They said that in their short time visiting here, they felt exactly the same community that they had already built in London. They felt it was a very good fit, and so the first tech hub outside London was announced as Riga.
Co-working is a pretty new thing in the Baltics. That's the idea where flexible workers who perhaps work non-traditional hours and care mostly about internet access can come together in one place. In addition to being cheaper than a regular office, the open layout is designed to help new business meet each other and work together. As of February, there are going to be 35 to 40 permanent desks for resident startups who will have to pay a monthly fee of €80 per month. That's a steal compared to the almost €315 per month that TechUp London companies pay. the rest of the office will be a drop-in area. That means that if you pay an annual fee of 360 euros, you'll be free to use an available desk during workdays. But the physical space is just a means to an end, says Anders Berzinch.
What we're hoping is that this is the home of the new Skype that will come out of Latvia, that this is a, you know, it's a great place for technology startups. There's a lot of very talented people in the development side, on the design side, a lot of ambition and a culture of hard working, which is very important for a startup.
Skype, of course, was created in Latvia's northern neighbor Estonia. Berzin says that the number of local startups has boosted in recent years. Though there's no statistics about how many new IT companies have emerged lately, there are some very interesting startups that most people outside of Latvia probably haven't heard of. They've got names like Amuse, Cobook, Reachly, RentMum and Sunnyride, and they're all eager to work at TechHub. It's no surprise that half of the hub space is already full, as 9 startups have already booked their permanent desks at the co-working space. One of such Latvian startups is also Mighty Fingers, a 7-man company that creates real-time multiplayer online games. Gati Šmaukselis is the CEO of the company.
Right now, there's a big problem in the gaming industry, but you have to make game once, for example, for iPhone, and afterwards you have to make it like the same game you make second time for Android or for other device or operating system. We are making technology which allows to make game once and run in all devices.
Gati Šmaukselis explains that their engine uses HTML5. That means everyone can play it in a browser without installing it on the computer. Šmaukselis and his colleagues are still working on the app and hope that his work at TechHub will help get their company noticed and to attract investment. And that's why there's a great need for advice from both local and international IT experts among the Latvian startups.
Most of the incubators I visited in Latvia provide only basically with the office space. They do try to organize some seminars, try to attract experts, but this is not something which is ongoing and systematically organized.
That's Anne Sauka, the head of business department at the Stockholm School of Economics in Riga. He says that just like in Silicon Valley or Berlin, a close-knit geography is very important.
Community is more than ready. It's a bit more problematic with the infrastructure. So I really hope that this IT incubator will create this framework for this creativity to foster and business to happen.
TechHub and the Riga Tech community are trying to build on some of the buzz that already exists in the region. There are already regular events like the Finnish startup Sona and Estonia's Garage 48. TechCrunch is already planning a launch event to show off the best Baltic startups when the co-working space opens on February 9th. Gedars Džiauzis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Riga.
If you like, you can download Digital Europe as a separate podcast. Just search for DW Digital Europe in iTunes. Coming up, new Swedish research into Alzheimer's has some surprising results. But first, here's Sam Edmonds with the news.
The world's biggest tech convention, the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, gets underway this week in Las Vegas. Starting on Tuesday, over 100,000 people are expected to attend this massive get-together, showcasing the industry's latest innovations. European companies attending the show include Tobii, a Swedish firm that's developed new eye-tracking laptop technology. Meanwhile, French company Withings is unveiling a baby scale that connects to a smartphone. This year's CES also features 44 exhibitors from Britain. That's 20% more than last year, making Britain the best represented European country in Vegas. Speaking of the UK, many parts of London are set to get free Wi-Fi later this year. Spanish telecom company O2 has struck a deal with the boroughs of Westminster, Kensington and Chelsea to create what the company is calling the largest free wireless hub in Europe. London is set to receive many thousands of new visitors this summer as part of the 2012 Olympic Games. The City of London has said that no taxpayer money will be spent on the new Wi-Fi project. A file-sharing group known as the Church of Copimism has been officially recognised as a spiritual organisation by Sweden's Financial and Administrative Services. The government institution allows recognised groups, which include mainstream religions as well as Norse pagans, to apply for state funding and to marry couples. The Church of Copimism has ties to the controversial website The Pirate Bay and The Pirate Party, which both originated in Sweden. Its 3,000 members say information is holy and copying is a sacrament. The Anonymous Computer Hacker Collective launched a campaign against neo-Nazi groups in the new year. Its so-called Operation Blitzkrieg disabled a number of websites associated with Germany's far-right National Democratic Party, or NPD. It also launched a new site called NaziLeaks.net, which lists the names, addresses and contact details of hundreds of people who've been communicating or doing business with a variety of far-right websites. That includes customers of the Tor Steinar clothing group based in Berlin and individuals who contributed money to the NPD. And finally, German paleontologists announced the discovery of a new species of marine reptile last week. Researchers from the State Natural History Museum in Braunschweig said their rare ichthyosaur fossil is 130 million years old, which means it's from the Lower Cretaceous era. That turned some heads because most ichthyosaur fossils come from the Jurassic era, millions of years earlier. The newly discovered species, unearthed during roadworks in 2005, has been given the Latin name Acamptonectones densis, which means stiff swimmer.
Sam Edmonds with the news there. One of the major issues for hospitals and health professionals is the worldwide increase in bacteria that have developed resistance to antibiotics. Now, scientists in the Austrian city of Graz have developed an antibiotic which they claim does not lead to bacterial resistance. Research on the development has only been partly published in scientific journals due to pending patents, and the drug is still some years away. But still, as Carrie Skyring reports from Graz, it's been described as a breakthrough.
Come on, Jack. Hurry up now.
Morning in the Llewellyn Johnson household. Stephanie, a mother of three, is urging 8-year-old Jack to take his antibiotics before school.
Can you take those tablets now?
Jack was born with cystic fibrosis, a genetic disease resulting in frequent lung infections. His health depends on antibiotics.
Any inkling of an infection coming along, we have to put him on antibiotics. And throughout the winter months, he's on antibiotics all the time.
It's so quiet in here.
Sorry.
No mice running around.
No, we don't have mice, only cell cultures.
Yeah.
Young Jack's life and the lives of others, including AIDS sufferers who are dependent on antibiotics, could be lengthened or even saved by work going on in this laboratory. The Graz Institute for Biophysics and Nano Research. It's here that Dr. Karl Lohner leads a small team tracking down the so-called super antibiotic, the one which can knock out the super bugs. Bacteria, which have developed resistance to all known antibiotics.
So I'm always a little bit cautious with terms like superbugs, but it's really true that lately we are reading more often about incidences where we face bacteria that are resistant to practically all antibiotics which are on the market.
Last year, Karl's Institute was awarded a United States patent for a new antibiotic, which, at least during tests on mice, does not lead to bacterial resistance. Patents for the rest of the world are pending, but it will still be a while before this new drug becomes available. Clinical trials testing safety in humans haven't even started yet, and those usually take years.
Most of the antibiotics act what I usually like to describe with a key and lock principle. That means that the antibiotic has a very specific target on the bacteria, either on the cell wall or inside the bacteria, binding, for example, to DNA, preventing replication.
If current antibiotics use a key in the lock principle to get at the bacteria, this new one uses the smash down the door principle. Antimicrobial peptides identified by the Graz team attack the bacteria's membrane and destroy it. This new approach has drawn the attention of other scientists in the field.
So Karl's work actually, that a specific set of peptides, cationic peptides, act as antimicrobial agents, have in fact kind of revolutionized the drug discovery in the world of antibiotics.
That's Dr. Uwe von Asen, head of the Molecular Diagnostic Unit at the Austrian Institute of Technology in Vienna. He's not involved in the Graz team.
In contrast to current antibiotics where a specific molecular target has been identified, here the difference is, in fact, that the membrane, the bacterial membrane, is the target of this new drug. Yeah, and this is really unprecedented contrast to the other antibiotics.
People keep on asking me why I ever christened anything penicillin. Well, if you knew a little botany, you'd know.
That was a recording from the 1950s by the Scottish biologist Alexander Fleming. He discovered penicillin, the world's first commercial antibiotic, in 1928. When Fleming received the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1945, he was already warning that misuse of antibiotics could lead to bacterial resistance. And today in Vienna, Uwe von Arsen says Fleming's predictions have come true.
This problem of antibiotic resistance is not only restricted nowadays to the hospitals, and there is really a severe problem, but also what is called community-acquired infections. That the problem of resistance is really spreading, unfortunately, into the community. Yeah, you and me can be infected, yeah.
And that's exactly why, back in Stephanie's kitchen, young Jack has to take so many antibiotics and rotate their frequency throughout the year.
At the moment, Jack has to take one oral antibiotic twice a day and one nebulized antibiotic in the evening. So we change that at the moment. During the winter months, we change that every month. So he changes from one antibiotic onto another one. So he's not continuously on that one.
And there's still a long way to go before Carl Lohner's team sees their antibiotic in use. Preclinical trials were successful, but clinical trials proving its safety in human use will take years and cost millions. And even then, Lohner says, we shouldn't underestimate the survival strategy of bacteria.
They will always survive, but we should have something in hands for quite a long period again that helps us to overcome the situation that you just described.
So take those first.
For 8-year-old Jack, breathing in antibiotics through a nebulizer, the super antibiotic, can't come soon enough. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Graz, Austria.
And finally today, let's stay on the science side of things with one more interview. Alzheimer's is a debilitating neurodegenerative disease associated with memory loss, dementia, and the eventual loss of motor functions. Often it's hard for doctors to officially diagnose someone with the disease until it has extensively progressed. According to Alzheimer's Disease International, nearly 10 million people suffer from dementia in Europe alone, with Alzheimer's accounting for the overwhelming majority of these cases. For years, scientists around the world have tried to come up with better treatments and a cure for the disease, but few have been shown to be particularly effective. In a new scientific paper published in the January 1, 2012 edition of the Archives of General Psychiatry, a team of Swedish researchers have now shown that it's possible to detect individuals with a high risk of developing Alzheimer's 10 years before they show any outward symptoms. If their technique proves successful, it could become an important tool for managing future Alzheimer's patients. To learn more, I spoke with Dr. Oskar Hansson, a professor of neuroscience at Lund University in Sweden and a co-author on the new paper. Now, I understand here that you have been working on Alzheimer's research for some time now, and from what I understand, your new findings suggest that it may be possible, or it is possible, to detect the onset of Alzheimer's disease 10 years before the outward appearance of symptoms. Is that correct?
What we show is that you can detect both people that are at high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease 10 years before they develop dementia. Then the test is not 100% accurate, so it's not possible to diagnose the patients before they develop dementia, but you can see those that you can identify those that have a very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease with dementia in the future.
How did you come about to determine this?
Actually, the research in this field have been going on for the last more than last 10 years. So these biomarkers, as we call them, beta amyloid and in cerebrospinal fluid and tau, have been known for quite some time to be associated then with Alzheimer's disease. So what we have been showing now is really that these change during the very early stages of the disease, but the biomarkers themselves have been known for quite some time.
So in other words, you're showing that through the presence of, by having the presence of these certain substances within the brain, then that suggests that there's a higher likelihood of somebody to develop the disease.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Now, previously, I understand you had been able to make a similar, you could call it a quasi-diagnosis, I guess, 5 years before the onset of outward symptoms. And now you've doubled that time frame to 10 years. What's changed?
Yeah, no, it's true. We have been following our same patient cohorts now for an additional 5-year period. So what is really interesting is then that we show that the disease process seemed to start then much earlier maybe than some of us thought. But also what is interesting is more from a basic scientific view is what we show that beta amyloid pathology, that is one of the pathologies in Alzheimer's disease, seem to be the earliest event that precede, for example, tau pathology that might come later on then. And this we show, I think, quite clearly in this study. And it might not have been studied that well before in humans.
Now, these substances that you're looking at, beta amyloid and tau, what are they exactly?
Beta amyloid is a small peptide, that is a small protein that takes part in plaques that are formed in the brain than in patients affected with Alzheimer's disease. And this has been known for a very long time. And tau is a protein that is mainly then inside the neurons that are affected in Alzheimer's disease. They form, we say, tangles within the neurons. And we believe what we see in the cerebrospinal fluid is that the levels of beta amyloid is decreased. And we believe that is due to it's stuck in this plaques in the brain. However, the tau protein is increased in the cerebrospinal fluid, and this might be due to that the neurons are being damaged and then tau leaks out of the neurons.
Does the value or the quantity of these substances in human bodies change over time?
Yes, and they change over time. Beta levels do not change that much with age. Tau increase slightly with age in general. But in Alzheimer's disease, they seem to change during the very, very early stages. We don't really know. We now show that it's at least 5 to 10 years before dementia, but maybe it occurs even earlier. We don't really know. But then after these have changed, they seem to be very stable during the disease.
What implications do you think that your findings have for Alzheimer's treatment and management?
I think mainly it has implications at the moment for clinical trials because many of the trials where they have evaluated the effects of new types of therapies that have been aiming at slowing down or stopping the disease, those have unfortunately not showed very promising results when they have been used in patients that are already demented. So we and many others propose that you should start these trials at an earlier stage when the patients only have very mild symptoms. But then you, of course, need to identify these individuals. So we believe, and many others, that you can identify patients with very early symptoms then that are high risk of developing AD or Alzheimer's disease later on, using, for example, cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers, but also using other types of, for example, brain imaging with positron emission tomography. And if you identify these individuals that have very little symptoms but a high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, I think the likelihood of finding positive effects of these new therapies will be much higher because then you can initiate the therapy before you have widespread neuronal injury and maybe before then that the changes are irreversible.
All right. Well, Dr. Oscar Hansson, thank you very much for your time and best of luck in your research.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Dr. Oscar Hansson is a professor of neuroscience at Lund University in Sweden. That's all for this week on Spectrum. In between episodes, you can always find daily news updates at dw-world.de/science. Email your questions and comments to feedback.english@dw-world.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.